Can generative AI make rockets launch faster? Hello and welcome to Tech First. My name is John Katsir. I've done a ton of Tech Firsts on generative AI. It's getting pretty good. OpenAI just announced it can see, listen, talk back. What about the enterprise? What about companies, big organizations? Specifically, what about NASA? A generative AI solution is apparently helping NASA do what used to take weeks, take it down to days. Thanks, of course, to generative AI. To dig in, we're joined by Stardog CEO Kendall Clark. Welcome, Kendall.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Hey, great name, Stardog. I mean, like, that's an awesome name for a company. I guess my first question is, so is NASA going to Mars next month thanks to generative AI?
when NASA returns to the moon and goes to Mars for the first time is more a function of the U.S. Senate, to be honest with you. And those budgets and that sort of thing, it's obviously an expensive endeavor. But to answer your question, I think generative AI can help speed up a lot of complex things, largely around, I think in this first wave, there's going to be a bunch of waves. And I think most of the interest among the educated public, or people who are paying attention, right? It's not everybody, we should remind ourselves. The people who are paying attention largely because of its impact in what we call B2C space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, help me make a invitation for my children's 7th birthday party and make it have dragons and fairies and something else and out pop these amazing photos. We've all played with that. And I love it. I'm sort of addicted to it, frankly. I can't make a deck now without having some generative AI images. So much so that my employees now tease me about it. You know, Stardog is a great brand, partially because it lends itself so well
I have dog a whole folder. In space.
I have a folder called Astronaut Dogs on my computer that's got God knows how many variations. I'm obsessed. In the enterprise, I think the first impact from generative AI will be in what we can call question answering, the movement from query writing to question answering.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that something like, and I'll just make this up, 60% of the value, more than half of the value that enterprises get from technology, information technology at all, is in the area of answering questions of data. And the dominant way that's happened to date is there is some data in a database somewhere. There's a lot of those, in fact. And someone who's either very smart or someone who spent a lot of money on a product like Tableau, maybe, some kind of BI tool, does something, you know, manipulates an interface in some way, and that results in a simple to very complex query, often SQL query. That SQL query goes to a system, gets executed, an answer comes back, and value is achieved because the answer says false instead of true, or it says, you know, 17,000 instead of minus 17,000, or it says John instead of Kendall, or whatever, right?
Or more likely you discover, oh, shoot, that was actually not the right question to ask the data. I should have asked this question. And then you send that question back to the data analyst. The data analyst goes, why did this idiot tell me the wrong question in the first place? And then runs that query. And there takes another level of time. And then you go back and forth. And finally, you dial in 5 or 6 levels down. You have what you think might actually be the real answer you want it.
You're 100% on it. And what that means is there is space, organizational friction. Now, you know, people are employed because of this friction to make it work anyway, but there's space between my intent of wanting to ask a question of the data through the process that gets translated into a query, mm-hmm. either by a piece of software or by some people or both typically. And then it gets executed and then it comes back to me and, oh, it wasn't quite. And this is a little bit like, I mean, for the folks in your audience who are IT-minded or history of IT-minded, this is a little bit what it was like to write code in the 60s or even in the 70s. Like, you got 2 chances to ask questions, you know, to make changes to your code base per day because the compiler and the tool chain and the nature of the languages and the slowness of the computers back then, it, you know, you'd start your morning run. It took 4 hours to compile. You went and found something else to do. You came back at noonday. Oh, shit, I forgot a semicolon or something like that, right? Oh, run it again. The day is shot. But now we use these, you know, super fast computers, high-level languages, you know, dynamic compilers, stuff like Python. I can ask a million questions. So the iterative cycle has sped up tremendously for programmers. For generative AI in the enterprise, the first big impact, my prediction is, not even a prediction, what I think is we're already seeing is the movement from query answering query writing, which is this process we've been talking about, which works, but it's slow and it's error prone and it's got a lot of extra people in it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people between the data and my intent. That's going to get all compressed. And so question answering is the LLM takes the place of all that space, right? And it says, oh, if you're asking, what is the assessed or what is the test readiness of this subcomponent of this subcomponent of the humans of the manned space capsule return to moon thing, and you know, give me the full lineage and traceability of all the, like, that's a complex question that's literally rocket science, right? And the answer, you know, now if people can, you know, not just technical people, but something like everyone, knowledge workers, can interact with the data, I will say directly from their experiential point of view, although there's a lot of stuff in between, obviously, a big stack, that's going to compress all those cycles, much like the rise of dynamic languages did for programming, programmer productivity. We're going to see that in what you would call just we used to call a general office worker, you know, people, but now business analysts, knowledge workers, people who need, whose job depends on interrogating the data. Where, you know, now, according to normal technology, interrogating is a metaphor, right? It's like a fancy word. In the LLM era, question answering era, interrogating is not a metaphor anymore. We've concretized the metaphor. We've made it literal. You're literally like, you know, what about this? What about this? What about this? Firing questions at the data by typing them out. As you say, you know, opening, I extend this to this kind of verbal thing. But that's a fun thing, but it's not going to really make a difference to the questions you get back, I don't think. But yeah, that's what's good. That's the first thing we're going to see. I think that's the original nub of your question. So in that sense, it can help everything that NASA does, everything that all of our customers, everything that everyone who's engaging this technology can help them make their jobs go faster and better, because effectively, I like to say, democratizes access to data.
So it's interesting, because when I got the pitch for you to jump on the podcast, what I immediately thought of was enterprise knowledge management. And there've been huge products and projects that enterprises have been going on for, I want to say, decades, and I don't even think that's an exaggeration, of enterprise knowledge management. What do we know? How do we categorize what we know? How do we put it in a place where, you know, people can access it? How do we search it? How do we surface it? And as we were sort of pre-chatting before we started recording, saying, hey, that's not our space. We're not about that sort of static data, that static knowledge in documents and stuff like that. We're about data. Talk about the evolution of knowledge management, or how you fit or contrast to it.
Yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, I feel like I'm cynical about knowledge management. But that's the average view. I think, you know, as we were talking before, you said, you know, you signaled some of that in yourself. I think the let's start with the fair thing to say. I think the fair thing to say is it has made sense at all points since, let's say, I don't know, 1970, for big companies to make some investments in really what we should call it is library science, because that's really what it is. And I don't mean that in a, I mean, I guess I kind of played it for a joke a little bit, but I mean it. I mean, seriously, you know, librarians serve a really super useful function in our society by organizing knowledge, right? Like, I like, and I know, you know, no one in your audience or who's listening to us who's under, what would you say, 40, certainly no one under 30 will know what these next words mean. But remember, you used to be able to go to a library. It was a place, right, in the world. It's not the mall. And it had knowledge in it, primarily in the form of books, but other forms as well. And there were these people there who basically organized that knowledge, and they sat there and waited all day for you to come in and ask a question, and they loved to help you answer that question. That was the way that our society worked, right? It was this kind of a socialist vision, frankly, strictly speaking, that knowledge was a common asset that we had created as a civilization. We should all have equal access to it. You could even use people to call them on the telephone and say, I'm writing a story about the winter migration of carrier pigeons in Finland. I don't know, something, whatever. And they'd go, okay, there's a book about that. Come get it. They'd be very excited. And then you would read it and you would know stuff. The web kind of ruined that, or destroyed it, or changed it, altered it forever. But I still think and in some ways, what's happening with the web, what Google has done is find a way to make the machines do a lot of that work. Mm-hmm. And so with respect to documents, websites, web is just a collection of documents. After all, we mostly self-serve. We go into the search bar. This is what people, you know, everybody knows how to do. That's kind of replaced that call a librarian. But it's the same. We're satisfying the same human need. So with respect to knowledge management, doing that for large bodies of information inside of a big enterprise, I mean, my hat's off. They're on the side of the angels, right? I don't think you can be cynical about that. What I think we can be cynical about is there was always this obvious to me collision course between what we typically call data management, enterprise data management, you know, ETL, databases, data warehouses, and knowledge management. Then those mm-hmm. needed to kind of, like, as I like to say, be on a collision course, smash together, mutate into some new thing. And I think that's been obvious. It's obviously been the case for the last, say, 3 or 4 years that's happened. LLM in particular makes it, I don't think you can deny that anymore, that this question answering capability we were talking about previously, and then you can extend question answering to all the other traditional jobs to be done in data management, data modeling, data mapping, data quality, discovery, metadata management, inference rules, and then the traditional realm of data science. That machine learning has kind of eaten all those things in a way that's now really accessible to everyone, not just to Google. And that's going to forever change the practice of data management, just like the web forever changed the practice of library science and knowledge organization. That's my non-cynical take on what's happening.
It's really interesting, actually, if you could somehow study and understand what percentage of human knowledge, let's say, resided in dead trees. And then how that moved to documents, electrons in hard drives, and how that transition is happening as a greater and greater percentage of our operational knowledge transitions to maybe more dynamic forms of knowledge that are in databases, that are measuring processes that are ongoing, that are real time in a lot of senses. And that's an interesting transition of what percentage of the world's knowledge is in different places. Certainly the percentage in databases, that is a live database that is growing, that is measuring live activity, and that you want to query because you want to know the status of that live activity, is certainly growing. And being able to access that easily is really, really impressive.
Okay, so this is a super interesting question. You forgot, or you didn't mention, I should say, a third important source, which is the knowledge that only resides in and between people. Yeah, exactly. Right. That for a variety of reasons, people didn't need to write down. They haven't had time to write down, or it's just too fluid and it doesn't fit in a database. The thing about, you don't really put stuff into a database until it has this kind of particular kind of ossification of form, by which I mean, you know, in a database, traditionally what we mean by database is a relational database, a particular data model. It's not the most agile, flexible thing. In fact, it's kind of rigid. Mm-hmm. Relational databases were typically intended for basically accounting data. And accounting data, whatever else it is, it's not dynamic and fluid and creative. The values may change. You know, you have a status of the of an account that changes. But the rules of
structure.
Right. The gap rules are pretty, I mean, it goes back to what, 16th century Florence, double entry accounting. I mean, a lot of that stuff is really old and well understood. Then you jump ahead to somebody like NASA, literally trying to do rocket science, get humans back and forth across the solar system, and they're learning new things every day. They're right on the cusp of the barrier between, or the boundary, the border between knowledge and ignorance. You know, on the other side of what we know is the black, scary nothingness of ignorance, right? And if you're trying to peck away at that, push that border out a little bit every day, you may need different techniques for data management. So what I think is interesting, and then you add to that the fact that while you say that the big historical trend is to go from books to electronic form, all of the growth in the next 10 years forecasted for enterprise data is not in what we call structured data, databases. It's in semi-structured and unstructured data. So like this conversation 20 years ago was two guys talking, right? Mm-hmm. This conversation 5 years ago was a thing you could watch on YouTube. This conversation now or anytime in the future you know, I push a button at the end, you push a button, out pops a transcript. We stick that into some kind of knowledge platform, and all the entities and everything we mentioned, you know, I mentioned migratory patterns of birds in Finland, and we mentioned libraries, and you mentioned, you know, like those
gap accounting rules.
Those will all pop up as nodes in a graph, the knowledge graph, right? And connections between them. And, you know, then, okay, this is a conversation of a different kind, but if we're doing this for work, this might be work product, right? So transition about where the knowledge is, you know, what they call in the academia, the sociology of knowledge, the production of knowledge, thinking about knowledge getting produced, like thinking about cars getting produced. It's an industry, and there are processes, and there's inputs and outputs, and you can measure it. And, you know, there's this whole big field since probably the 80s in academia studying the output of knowledge. What we're talking about, and when we were talking about knowledge management and data management colliding and fusing into a new thing, taking a lot of those techniques, a lot of the new algorithmic insights, and helping big companies manage the data that they produce better. I mean, I will say, I'll stop with this. I don't want to give you a filibuster here, but, you know, it's interesting to think about companies' competitive landscape vis-a-vis one another. Like, you take two big global pharmaceutical companies, maybe the most differentiated assets they have are their data sets. Like, you cannot, I mean, you could maybe swap all the people, and the people at one pharma can do the jobs, and there's some, you know, winners and losers at the margins. But if you took, the easiest way to destroy a company is a thought experiment, is to take all their data and swap it with their nearest competitor. Just so you come work on Monday, and let's say all of GSK's data belongs to Novo Nordisk, and vice versa. Like, you haven't destroyed anything. Every bite's preserved, right? But you just swapped. Like, what happens? They're destroyed, right? So it's difficult to, I think it's difficult to overemphasize or exaggerate the importance of managing data and managing knowledge. And yeah, generative AI, given that it produces text, and all of this knowledge and data management ultimately more or less ends up in text, let's say images or a form of text, right? Close enough. The applicability of these techniques to this area is pretty endless.
Yeah, it's an interesting space. And I just came back from Salesforce's big Dreamforce conference in San Francisco, and they've added a ton of generative AI to Tableau, which you've already mentioned. Other products as well. Their vision also is that you can query your data, natural language, anyone can do it. Everyone is a data scientist, all that stuff, right? And so that's super powerful. Of course, if you are going to buy Salesforce, I'm pretty sure you're in for significant charges for each user and significant challenges there. But it is a compelling vision, that all the data that the company produces is at your fingertips, that you have control over, that you have access to, that you have permissions for, right? And you can query it. You can know what's going on. You're a sales rep. You're a sales manager. You're a product manager. You can instantly know all this stuff. How does your vision differentiate from that?
Well, at a high enough level, it isn't. I mean, that's exactly what we want to do. I think there are differences that matter. I mean, first off, I would say Stardog's really focused. We're focused on financial services, pharma, and manufacturers of a certain size. And unlike Salesforce, now it's interesting. Salesforce is an interesting example because they did not start off as a data management company, enterprise data management company.
Correct.
They have become an enterprise data management company because strategically they decided to move in that direction because they make a lot of money and they got, you know, kind of frankly, excess capital they need to deploy. And they could have done many things, I suppose, but moving into data management makes sense because they do control a critical, a strategically critical corporate data asset in terms of the CRM, and that gives you some leverage. And so it's clear with the acquisition of MuleSoft a couple of years ago, six or whatever that was a big signal. Hey, we're going to be a data management company. But I think it's important. I think probably the biggest differentiation between our vision and theirs is Salesforce is really a cloud company, and they're really best at managing and connecting data that exists in the cloud. But companies still have a lot of data in what we call on-prem, not in the cloud. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And our focus has always been on that data that either hasn't gone to the cloud or will never go to the cloud, right? Mm-hmm. So Stardog is a cloud platform, but it also can operate on-prem. It's a Kubernetes platform, which for technical folks in your audience, yep, just means, you know, Kubernetes basically replaced the Java virtual machine as the enterprise delivery mechanism, the dominant one. But that just means we can operate our platform. Our customers operate it both on-prem and in any cloud environment. Excuse me. That just means Stardog can be adjacent to data no matter where it is, not mm-hmm. just the part of the data that's in the cloud. Even if in the end, you know, in the next 10 years, let's say 80% of all corporate data resides in the cloud, 20% of all enterprise data is still a very large amount of data. And yep, it needs to be connected. And what we're really focused on is connecting data and then making it accessible with this LLM technology we've been discussing in what I like to call the high, well, everyone calls the hybrid multi-cloud. So that part of the data that's on-prem hasn't moved to the cloud yet, or again, my favorite statistic, 85% of all businesses, irrespective of size, have data assets in more than one cloud. Now, for mm-hmm. most businesses, that means they have Salesforce and HubSpot, right? And, exactly. Which is fine. And those are different
solutions.
Yeah, they're different clouds. But really, you know, that problem is going to get solved for SMB and small businesses kind of by those vendors. But it's true of big businesses, you know, like our big banking customers have data everywhere in every conceivable location, format.
That is not comforting that the financial industry has its data everywhere.
Well, I mean, you know, that doesn't mean they're not controlling it, but I just mean by everywhere, I mean, you know, like what's the newest, like most globally significant banks are unlike, say, Facebook in one important regard. Facebook is like a teenager of a business, and globally significant banks are like grandparents. They're on mm-hmm. average, what, 75, 100, 150 years old. So mm-hmm. they've existed longer than computers have existed, which just means you take a cross-sectional slice of a big bank, you're looking at the archaeology of the last 70 years of IT. They started with mainframes, or what was even before a mainframe, you know, boxes of punch cards or whatever. And they got one of everything, and there's legacy all over the place. I mean, they have data everywhere in that sense. Now, that may also not comfort you, which is fair. But that's a tough problem to solve. You've got a system that's running. It works. It meets requirements. It's just old. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you meet some IT people and their smart view is don't mess with that. Leave it alone. It's running. Why mess with it? And then, you know, somebody else equally smart says, no, we need to modernize that. Nobody's right or wrong there. It's just, it's a hard problem. Not to come on your show and make a brief for banks, but you get my point. Like, they're in a tough spot when your organization's 150 years old. Right.
They are in a tough spot, and that's why we see the rise of neobanks, but we are straying way far afield. So we're going to pull it back here. So you're building your solutions so that organizations can query their data. That's great. NASA's using it. Others are using it. How do you solve hallucinations? That's obviously a challenge with generative AI, and that's a problem you cannot have in your scenario. That's a problem I'm okay with. If I talk to OpenAI, does it pass the sniff test? I can double check it. Google just added, or Bard just added, some double checking of yeah, what it says as well. How do you solve hallucinations?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a cheating answer to this question, which is what we're doing. And then there's the hard research question of like making the LLM stop hallucinating. I won't address that. That's a research question. It will get solved, I suspect, to some appreciable level of you know, quality, precision and recall. I think the first thing to say is LLMs are not databases, and they should not be treated like databases. The way we solve it, which is like somewhat cheating, is we don't use LLMs and Stardog as a source of data. We use it as a mechanism to discern human intent, which is a kind of a fancy way of saying, what is the person talking about in their natural language? You know, whether that's one of my co-founders is, my CTO is born in Istanbul, so he speaks Turkish and English. And I said to him at some point, I said, like, how's the LLM working in Turkish? As kind of as a joke. I knew they worked for many natural languages, but not necessarily for all of them. And he just showed me a demo. This was this summer, and it was just straight up Turkish, and it just worked. It was amazing. So we use the LLM as a way to figure out what the person is talking about, translate that into a query or a search or a hybrid query search or a data modeling, you know, piece or a data mapping piece or a rule or something that then gets executed by our platform. And that cuts out the chance for hallucination. What it means is, like, sometimes the LLM will get the human intent determination wrong. Mm-hmm. But then that just means a query. Now we're just back in the case you said earlier. Someone mm-hmm. expressed a need for a business question. Some other mechanism translated that into some query and didn't get it right.
Yeah.
Frankly, relative to the status quo, so what? Like that, that happens how many times?
You just redo it. You just redo it. And I've been in that scenario quite frequently. And usually it's not the data analyst who got it wrong. Usually it's me who asked the wrong question.
Well, not you specifically, but yes, almost always. It is just, frankly, and I tell the team this all the time, an LLM is not magic. It cannot determine intent when no crisp intent exists yet. But that's okay. People often find our way by asking a kind of, frankly, not very good question. And then we ask a slightly better question. And then we iteratively improve. And then we discover what our intent was all along. More like probably we create the intent in this iterative process. And then we retroactively attribute it to ourselves. And it's a psychological thing we do. And that's fine. Right? Mm-hmm. Oh, what I meant all along was this. Well, probably not. It's what you mean now. And here's the answer. Fine. Like nobody's mm-hmm. throwing rocks at those people. It's just normal human stuff. So in our approach, we don't treat we don't ask the LLM any questions that where its hallucinations can bother us. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so in the near term, that's the best solution. It's not, this is use case specific and context relative. Like that's what you want to do in a regulated industry where the questions really matter.
Yep.
But, you know, if I want another cool picture of an astronaut dog in, you know, Midjourney or something, I want that slightly random, quote unquote, wrong component because that's really the source of creativity.
Absolutely. And creativity is a wonderful thing, just not always when you're querying data from your own company.
That's exactly right.
Kendall, this was interesting. It went places I didn't expect it would. Thank you for taking the time.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.